our first harbinger of the horrible land ahead. I took two more pills and fell back asleep. Then, music filled the room, ever so faintly, and over the span of a couple of minutes it gradually got louder. I'm starting with the man in the mirror. It was Michael Jackson, a wake-up call coming from the speakers, and there was a blazing crack between the window shade and wall.
"Well, good morning," said the voice over the PA.
After his ominous pause, he continued,
"For those of you who haven't had the pleasure of looking out the window, welcome to Antarctica." With those words, I shot up. "Many of you are already on deck relishing the clear, still morning. We got our first glimpse of land at 6:23 when we came upon Snow Hill Island. We're now making our way into Deception Bay." I yanked the cord on the shades. There it was, a black rocky island with snow on top, black water under it, and a big gray sky above. Antarctica.
I got a huge knot in my stomach because if Antarctica could talk, it would be saying only one thing. "You don't belong here."
"The Zodiacs will begin loading at 9:30, the Kiwi continued. "Our naturalists and camera experts will be leading the walks, and kayaks are always available for those who prefer to go kayaking. The temperature is minus 13 degrees Celsius, 8 degrees Fahrenheit. Good morning, and again, welcome to Antarctica."
Dad burst in. "You're up. How about a swim?"
"A swim?"
"It's a volcanic island," he said. "There's a hot spring, which warms a patch of water near the shore. What do you say? Do you want to take a dip in the Antarctic Ocean?"
"No."
I was looking back at myself. It was like the old bee was standing there saying to me, "What are you talking about? That's something you'd love to do. Kennedy would freak." But the new bee was the one who controlled my voice, and she answered, "You can go, Dad."
"I have a feeling you're going to change your mind," Dad said all sing-song, but we both knew he was faking.
Days passed. I could never tell what time it was because the sun never set, so I went by Dad. He'd set his alarm for 6 a.m. like at home, then go to the gym, then I'd hear Michael Jackson singing, and Dad would come back to shower. He figured out a system where he'd bring clean underwear into the bathroom and emerge in that, then get dressed the rest of the way in the room. Once he said, "It's the damnedest thing. I can't find my neti pot anywhere." Then he'd head off to breakfast. He'd return with a plate of food for me and a Xerox of the 6-page New York Times Digest, which had big handwritten letters across the top. "Front desk copy only. Do not bring to room." It was printed on the back of the previous day's leftover menus. I liked seeing what fish they served the night before, because I'd never even heard of any of them. Things like toothfish, hake, wreckfish, and red porgy. I saved them in case Kennedy doesn't believe me. Then Dad, the layer king, would elaborately get into his expedition clothes and salve himself with sunblock, lip stuff, and eye drops and head out. Soon, black rubber boats with motors called Zodiacs would ferry the passengers ashore. After the last Zodiac headed out, I'd stir to life. It was just me and the vacuum cleaners. I'd go to the way top floor, which is the library, where I kept tabs on an epic Settlers of Catan game some passengers were playing. There were a bunch of jigsaw puzzles, too, which got me excited because I love puzzles. But inside the boxes, I'd find a note saying, "This puzzle is missing 7 pieces," or some number, and I thought, why would I do that puzzle? There was another lady there, too, who never got off the ship. I don't know why. She didn't talk to me, but was always working in a Sudoku Easy Does It book. On top of each page, she wrote the place where she did the puzzle, as a souvenir. They all said, "Antarctica." Mostly, though, I just sat in the library. It had glass on all sides, so I could see everything. All you need to know about Antarctica is its 3 horizontal stripes. On the bottom, there's the stripe for the water, which is anywhere from black to dark gray. And on top of that, there's the stripe for the land, which is usually black or white. Then there's a stripe for the sky, which is some kind of gray or blue. Antarctica doesn't have a flag, but if it did, it should be three horizontal stripes of different shades of gray. If you wanted to get really artsy, you could make it all gray, but say it was three stripes of gray for the water, the land, and the sky, but that would probably take too much explaining. Eventually, the flotilla of zodiacs would head back to the ship. I couldn't tell which one Dad was on, because all the passengers were issued the same red hooded parkas and matching snow pants, probably because red makes them stick out best against the gray. The guides get to wear black. I made sure I was back in my room when the first zodiac returned, so Dad would think I'd been moping. The housekeeper always left a towel twisted into the shape of a bunny on my pillow, and each day it got more elaborately accessorized. First, the towel bunny was wearing my dark glasses, then my hairband, then one of Dad's Breathe Right strips. Dad would burst in, still carrying the cold on his clothes, full of information and stories. He'd show me pictures on his camera and say the photos didn't do it justice. Then he'd go to the dining room for lunch and bring me back something. Then afterward, he headed back out for the afternoon excursion. My favorite time was the evening recap, which I'd watch on TV in my room. Every day the scuba divers went down and videotaped the sea floor. In this hostile black water, it turns out there are millions of the craziest sea creatures I'd ever seen. Things like glassy sea cucumbers, worms covered with graceful foot-long spikes, fluorescent-colored sea stars, and copepods, which are spotted and striped like out of Yellow Submarine. The reason I'm not calling any of them by their scientific names, not like I even would, is because they don't have names yet. Most of this stuff humans are seeing for the very first time. I tried to love Dad and not hate him for his fake cheer and the way he gets dressed. I tried to imagine what Mom saw in him back when she was an architect. I tried to put myself in the shoes of someone who finds every little thing he does a total delight. It was sad, though, because the thought of him and all his accessories always made me sick. I wish I'd never made the connection about Dad being a gigantic girl, because once you realize something like that, it's hard to go back. Sometimes it was so great I couldn't believe how lucky I was that I got to be me. We'd pass icebergs floating in the middle of the ocean. They were gigantic, with strange formations carved into them. They were so haunting and majestic you could feel your heart break. But really, they're just chunks of ice, and they mean nothing. There were ebony beaches dusted with snow, and sometimes there was a lone emperor penguin, giant with orange cheeks, standing on an iceberg. And you had no idea how he got there or how he was going to get off, or even if he wanted to get off. On another iceberg, a smiling leopard seal, sunning herself, looked like she wouldn't hurt a fly, but she's one of the most vicious predators on Earth, and she'd think nothing of leaping up and grabbing a human in her razor teeth and pulling him into the freezing water and shaking him until his skin slid off. Sometimes I looked over the edge of the ship at the sea ice, like white jigsaw puzzle pieces that will never fit together, and passing through sounded like clinking cocktails. There were whales everywhere. Once I saw a pod of 50 killer whales, mommies and babies, frolicking in a pack, blowing happily, and penguins hopping across the inky ocean like fleas, then propelling themselves to safety on an iceberg. If I had to choose, that would be my favorite part, the way the penguins pop out of the water and onto land. Hardly anyone in the world gets to see any of this, which put pressure on me to remember it especially well and to try to find words for the magnificence. Then I'd think of something random, like how Mom used to write notes to put in my lunch. She'd sometimes include one for Kennedy, whose mom never wrote her notes, and some were stories that would take weeks to play out. And then I'd get up from my seat in the library and look through the binoculars, but Mom was never there. Pretty soon, I stopped thinking about home and my friends, because when you're on a boat in Antarctica and there's no night, who are you? I guess what I'm saying is I was a ghost on a ghost ship, in a ghost land.
One night, it was the evening recap, and Dad brought me a plate of cheese puffs, then went back up to the lounge, and I watched it on TV. A scientist gave a presentation about counting penguin chicks as part of an ongoing study. Then it was time to announce the plan for tomorrow, which was going to Port Lockroy to a British military outpost left over from World War II, which was now an Antarctic Heritage Museum where people live and run a gift shop and a post office, where we are all encouraged to buy Antarctic penguin stamps and mail letters home. My heart started doing gymnastics, and I paced around wildly, repeating, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God," waiting for Dad to burst through the door.
"Well, ladies and gentlemen," came the voice through the speakers, "that was another wonderful recap. Chef Issei has just informed me that dinner is ready. Bon appetit."
I flew up to the lounge because maybe Dad was sitting there stunned, but the gathering had broken up. A pack of people was shuffling down the stairs. I ran to the back and took the long way to the dining room. There was Dad, sitting at a table with some guy.
"Bee," he said, "would you like to join us for dinner?"
"Wait, weren't you at the recap?" I asked. "Didn't you hear?"
"Yes, and this is Nick, who was studying the penguin colonies. He was telling me he always needs helpers to count penguin chicks."
"Hi." I was so scared of Dad in that moment that I took a step back and bumped into a waiter. "Sorry, sorry, hi, hi, bye." I turned around and walked as fast as I could out of there. I ran to the chart room, which is a gigantic table with a map of the Antarctic Peninsula laid across it. Each day I'd watch crew members mark our ship's path with a dotted line, and afterwards passengers would drop by and painstakingly copy it onto their maps. I pulled open a huge flat drawer and found the map of Mom's journey. I placed it on top and followed with my finger the dot, dot, dot. Sure enough, her ship had stopped at Port Lockroy. The next morning, Dad was at the gym, and I went out on deck. Plunked onto the rocky shore was a black wooden building, L-shaped, like two Monopoly hotels, with white window trim and cheery red shutters. Penguins dotted the landscape. The backdrop was a field of snow, looming over which was one big pointy mountain rising above seven smaller scrunched-together ones, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. Dad had signed up to go kayaking with the first group, then to Port Lockroy with the second group. I waited until he was gone, then ripped the tags off my red parka and snow pants and suited up. I fell in with the stream of passengers clomping, astronaut-like, down the stairs to the mudroom. It was full of lockers and had two huge openings on either side where floating docks were tethered. I headed down a ramp to a sputtering Zodiac.
"Port Lockroy," confirmed a crewman. "Did you scan out?"
He pointed me to a stand with a computer. I scanned my ID badge. My photo popped up on the screen, along with the words, "Enjoy your time ashore, Balakrishna." I felt a surge of annoyance at Manjula, who was supposed to have made sure I got called B, but then I remembered she was an internet bandit. A dozen red suits crammed into the Zodiac with Charlie at the motor. It was mostly women who had all seen enough penguins for one lifetime and felt the need to start shopping. They were bursting with questions about what there was to buy.
"I don't know," Charlie said with a tinge of resentment.
"T-shirts." It was the first time I'd been out on the glassy water. Bitter wind attacked me from all sides. My whole being instantly shrank, and any time I moved, my skin hit a new cold patch in my snowsuit, so I became trapped in stillness. I turned my head the teeniest bit possible, just enough to see the shore. The closer we got to Port Lockroy, the building strangely got smaller and smaller, which was the first time I got scared. Charlie gunned the engine and drove the Zodiac onto the rocks. I belly-rolled off the big inflated side and dropped my life jacket. I scrambled across the big rocks, avoiding the singing Gentoo penguins guarding their rock nests, until I reached a wooden ramp leading to the entrance. A British flag flapped in the cold, gray wind. I was the first one there, and I flung open the door. Two girls, college-aged,
kind of goofy and enthusiastic, greeted us. "Welcome to Port Lockroy," they said in British accents. It was one of those miserable situations where it was just as cold inside as it was outside. I was in a room with turquoise-painted walls. This was the gift shop, with colorful banners hanging from the ceiling, tables full of books, stuffed animals, and postcards, and glass cubbies of sweatshirts, baseball hats, and anything you could embroider a penguin on. There were no signs of Mom. But why would there be? This was just the gift shop. Across this room was an opening leading to the rest of Port Lockroy, but the English girls blocked it. I kept together and acted interested in the bulletin boards while the other passengers trickled in and oohed and aahed at the swag. Even the Sudoku lady had torn herself away from the library for this outing. "Welcome to Port Lockroy," alternated the girls. "Welcome to Port Lockroy." It seemed like we had been standing there for an hour already. "Where is everyone who lives here?" I finally asked. "Where do you live?" "You're looking at it," said one. "Let's wait for everyone to get in before we begin the lecture." Then they started up again. "Welcome to Port Lockroy." "But where do you sleep?" I asked. "Welcome to Port Lockroy. Is that everyone? Oh, we have some more coming." "Is there like a dining hall where everyone else is?" But the girls looked right over my head. "Welcome to Port Lockroy. Okay, it looks like we're all here." One of them began her spiel. "During World War II, Port Lockroy was a secret outpost for the British military." She stopped because the group of Japanese tourists had just entered, and with them, the usual low-grade confusion. I couldn't take it anymore. I squeezed past the English girls. There were two small rooms. I went left into an old-fashioned command center with desks and rusty machines full of dials and knobs, but no people. At the far end was a door marked "Do Not Open." I passed a wall of decaying books and pulled at the door. Blinding light blasted me back. It led outside to a snowfield. I closed the door and backtracked to the other room. In 1996... the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust paid to turn Port Lockroy into a living museum, one of the girls was saying. This room was a kitchen, with rusty stoves and shelves full of weird food rations and British tins. There also was a door marked "Do Not Open." I raced to that and yanked it open again. Eye-watering snow shock. I quickly shut the door. Once my eyes readjusted, I returned to the main section and tried to figure things out. Okay, there were only three doors, the front door where we came in, and these two other leading outside. "During the war, Port Lockroy was home to Operation Tabarin," the girls went on. "I don't understand," I butted in. "How many people live here?" "Just the two of us." "Where do you live?" I said. "Where do you sleep?"
"Here."
"What do you mean, here?"
"We roll our sleeping bags out in the gift shop."
"Where do you go to the bathroom?"
"We go outside."
"Where do you do your laundry?"
"Well, we..."
"Where do you shower?" "This is how they live," a tourist lady snapped at me. She had freckles, blue eyes, and a bunch of gray in her blonde hair. "Stop being rude. These girls come down for 3 months and pee in a tin can for the adventure."
"It really is just the two of you?" I said weakly.
"And the cruise ship passengers like you who come visit." "So nobody has, like, gotten off one of the ships to live with you?"
The sounds of the words coming out of my mouth and the whole idea that Mom would be here waiting for me struck me as so babyish that all of a sudden I burst into the most babyish tears. Swirled into my humiliation was anger at myself for letting my hope gallop off so stupidly. Snot sheeted down my face and into my mouth and down my chin and onto my new red parka, which I had been excited about because we got to keep it.
"Dear God," the freckled lady said. "What's wrong with her?"
I couldn't stop crying. I was trapped in the funhouse of pemmican rations, photographs of Doris Day, crates of whiskey, a rusty can of Quaker Oats where the Quaker Oats guy is a young man, Morse code machines, long johns with butt flaps hanging from a clothesline, and baby bibs that read, Antarctica Beach Club?
Charlie, chin lowered, spoke into the radio clipped to his parka.
Lots of concerned ladies asked, What's wrong?
Something I know how to say in Japanese, which is, Anata wa daijoburusu?
I burrowed through the gathering nylon mass and made it out the front door. I stumbled down the ramp, and when I got to the bottom, clambered over some big rocks as far as I could go and stopped at a little inlet. I looked back, and there were no people. I sat down and caught my breath. There was one elephant seal swaddled in her own blubber, lolling on her side. I couldn't imagine how she was ever going to move. Her eyes were big black buttons oozing black tears. Her nose, too, was oozing black. My breath was dense clouds. The cold seized me. I didn't know if I'd ever move again. Antarctica was truly a horrible place.
Bee, darling.
It was Dad.
Thank you, he said quietly to a Japanese lady who must have led him to me. He sat down and handed me a handkerchief.
I thought she was here, Dad.
I can see why you might have thought that, he said.
I cried a little, but then stopped. Still, the crying continued. It was Dad.
I miss her too, Bee. His chest jerked violently.
He was bad at crying.
I know you think you have a monopoly on missing her, but Mom was my best friend.
She was my best friend, I said.
I knew her longer.
He wasn't even being funny. Now that Dad was crying, I was like, both of us can't be sitting on rocks in Antarctica crying. It's gonna be okay, Dad.
You're absolutely right,
he said, blowing his nose.
It all started with that letter I sent to Dr. Kurtz. I was only trying to get Mom help. You have to believe me.
I do.
You're great, Bee. You've always been great. You're our biggest accomplishment.
Not really.
It's true.
He put his arm around me and pulled me close. My shoulder fit perfectly under his shoulder. I could already feel the warmth from his armpit. I nestled in closer.
Here, try these.
He reached into his parka and pulled out two of those pocket-warming heat biscuits. I yowled. They felt so good.
I know this trip has been hard on you, Dad said. It's not what you wanted it to be. He let out a big, gooey sigh. I'm sorry you had to read all those documents, Bee. They weren't meant for you. They weren't something a 15-year-old should have had to read.
I'm glad I read them. I didn't know Mom had those other babies. It made me feel like there were all these children Mom would rather have had and loved as much as she loved me, but I was the one who lived, and I was broken because of my heart.
Paul Jelinek was right, Dad said. He's a great guy, a true friend. I'd like us to go down to L.A. and spend some time with him one day. He knew Bernadette best. He realized that she needed to create.
Or she'd become a menace to society, I said.
That's where I really failed your mom, he said. She was an artist who had stopped creating. I should have done everything I could to get her back.
Why didn't you?
I didn't know how. Trying to get an artist to create? It's gigantic. I write code. I didn't understand it. I still don't. You know, I'd forgotten until I read that art form article that we used Mom's MacArthur money to buy Straightgate. It was like Bernadette's hopes and dreams were literally crumbling around us.
I don't know why everyone's so down on our house, I said.
Have you ever heard that the brain is a discounting mechanism?
No.
Let's say you get a present and open it and it's a fabulous diamond necklace. Initially, you're delirious with happiness, jumping up and down, you're so excited. The next day, the necklace still makes you happy, but less so. After a year, you see the necklace and you think, that old thing. It's the same for negative emotions. Let's say you get a crack in your windshield and you're really upset. Oh no, my windshield is ruined. I can hardly see out of it. This is a tragedy. But you don't have enough money to fix it, so you drive with it. In a month, someone asks you what happened to your windshield, and you say, What do you mean?
because your brain has discounted it.
The first time I walked into Kennedy's house, I said, it had that horrible Kennedy house smell because her mother's always frying fish. I asked Kennedy, what's that gross smell? And she was like, what smell?
Exactly, Dad said. You know why your brain does that?
Nuh-uh.
It's for survival. You need to be prepared for novel experiences because often they signal danger. If you live in a jungle full of fragrant flowers, you have to stop being so overwhelmed by the lovely smell because otherwise you couldn't smell a predator. That's why your brain is considered a discounting mechanism. It's literally a matter of survival.
That's cool.
It's the same with Straight Gate, he said. We've discounted the holes in the ceilings, the wet patches in the floors, the cordoned-off rooms. I hate to break it to you, but that's not how people live.
It's how we lived, I said.
It is how we lived.
A long time passed, which was nice. It was just us and the seal and Dad whipping out his chapstick. We were like the Beatles, Dad.
I know you think that, sweetie.
Seriously, Mom is John, you're Paul, I'm George, and ice cream is Ringo.
Ice cream, Dad said with a laugh.
Ice cream, I said. Resentful of the past, fearful of the future.
What's that? He asked, rubbing his lips together.
Something Mom read in a book about Ringo Starr. They say that nowadays he's resentful of the past and fearful of the future. You've never seen Mom laugh so hard. Every time we saw ice cream sitting there with her mouth open, we'd say, poor ice cream, resentful of the past, fearful of the future. Dad smiled a big smile. Su Lin, I started to say, but even uttering her name made it difficult to keep talking. She's nice, but she's like poop in the stew.
Poop in the stew? He said.
Let's say you make some stew, I explained. And it's really yummy and you want to eat it, right?
Okay, Dad said.
And then someone stirs a little bit of poop in it, even if it's just a teeny tiny amount, and even if you mix it in really well, would you want to eat it?
No, Dad said.
So that's what Su Lin is, poop in the stew.
Well, I think that's rather unfair, he said, and we both had to laugh.
It's the first time during this whole trip that I let myself really look at Dad. He had on a fleece headband over his ears and zinc oxide on his nose. The rest of his face was shiny from sunblock and moisturizer. He wore dark mountain-climbing glasses with the flaps on the side. The one lens that was taped over didn't show because the other lens was just as dark. There was really nothing to hate him for.
So, you know, Dad said, you're not the only one with wild ideas about what happened to Mom. I thought maybe she'd gotten off the ship, and when she saw me with Su Lin, she somehow dodged us. So you know what I did?
What?
I hired a bounty hunter from Seattle to go to Ushuaia and look for her.
You did? I said. A real-life bounty hunter?
They specialize in finding people far from home, he said. Someone at work recommended this guy. He spent 2 weeks in Ushuaia looking for Bernadette, checking the boats coming in and out, the hotels. He couldn't find anything. And then we got the captain's report.
Yeah, I said.
B, he said carefully, I have something to tell you. Have you noticed I haven't been frantic about not being able to get email?
Not really. I felt bad because only then did it occur to me that I hadn't thought about Dad at all.
It was true. He's usually all into his email. There's a huge reorg they're probably announcing as we sit on these rocks. He checked his watch. Is today the 10th?
I don't know, I said. Maybe.
As of the 10th, Samantha 2 is canceled.
Canceled? I didn't even understand how that word could apply.
It's over. They're folding us into games.
You mean for, like, the Xbox?
Pretty much, he said. Walter Reed pulled out because of budget cuts. At Microsoft, you're nothing if you don't ship. If Samantha 2 is under games, at least they can ship millions of units.
What about all those paraplegics you've been working with?
I'm in talks with the UW, he said. I'm hoping to continue our work over there. It's complicated because Microsoft owns the patents.
I thought you owned the patents, I said.
I own the commemorative cubes. Microsoft owns the patents.
So, like, you're gonna leave Microsoft?
I left Microsoft. I turned in my badge last week.
I'd never known Dad without his badge. A terrible sadness poured in through my head and filled me to the brim like I was a honey bear. I thought I might burst of sadness. That's so weird, is all I could say.
Is now a good time to tell you something even weirder? He said.
I guess, I said.
Sue Lynn is pregnant.
What?
You're too young to understand these things, but it was one night. I'd had too much to drink. It was over the moment it began. I know that probably seems really... What's a word you would use? Gross?
I never say gross, I said.
You just did, he said. That's what you called the smell at Kennedy's house.
She's really pregnant? I said.
Yep.
Poor guy. He looked like he was going to barf.
So basically, I said, your life is ruined. I'm sorry, but something in me made me smile. I can't say that thought hasn't occurred to me, he said. But I try not to think of it that way. I'm trying to frame it as my life being different. Our lives being different. Me and you.
So me and Lincoln and Alexandra are gonna have the same brother or sister?
Yep.
That's so random.
Random, he said. I've always hated when you use that word, but it is pretty random.
Dad, I said, I called her Yoko Ono that night because she was the one who broke up the Beatles. Not because she's Asian. I felt bad.
I know that, he said.
It was good that zappy-eyed seal was there because we could both just watch her. But then Dad started putting in eye drops. Dad, I said, I really don't mean to hurt your feelings, but...
But what?
You have way too many accessories. I can't keep track of all of them.
It's a good thing you don't have to, isn't it?
We were quiet for a while, and then I said, I think my favorite part of Antarctica is just looking out.
You know why? Dad asked. When your eyes are softly focused on the horizon for sustained periods, your brain releases endorphins. It's the same as a runner's high. These days we all spend our lives staring at screens 12 inches in front of us. It's a nice change.
I have an idea, I said. You should invent an app so that when you're staring at your phone, it tricks your brain into thinking you're staring at the horizon so you can get a runner's high from texting.
What did you just say?
Dad spun his head to look at me, his mind in high gear. Don't you dare steal my idea! I gave him a shove.
Consider yourself warned.
I groaned and left it at that. Then Charlie came over and said it was time to head back. At breakfast, Nick the penguin counter asked me again if I'd be his assistant, which did sound pretty fun. We got to leave before everyone else in our own zodiac. Nick let me stand next to the outboard and steer. The best way to describe Nick would be to say that he didn't have any personality, which sounds mean, but it's kind of true. The closest he came to personality was when he told me to scan the horizon wide like a searchlight, back and forth, back and forth. He said after he was down here the first time driving a Zodiac, that he went back home and immediately got into a car accident because he was looking left to right, and ended up rear-ending the car directly in front of him. But that's not personality. That's just a car accident. He dropped me off at an Adelie penguin colony and gave me a clipboard with a satellite map marked with some boundaries. This was a follow-up to a study a month back where another scientist had counted the eggs. It was my job to see how many had successfully hatched into chicks. Nick sized up the colony.
This looks like a complete breeding failure, he shrugged.
I was shocked by how casually he said this. What do you mean, a complete failure?
Adelies are hardwired to lay their eggs in the exact same place each year, he said. We had a late winter, so their nesting grounds are still covered with snow when they made their nests. So it looks like there's no chicks.
How can you even tell? Because there was no way I could see that.
You tell me, he said. Observe their behavior and tell me what you see.
He left me with a clicker and headed off to another colony saying he'd return in 2 hours. Adelies may be the cutest penguins of all.
Their heads are pure black except for perfect white circles like a reinforcement around their tiny black eyes. I started at the top left corner and clicked each time I saw a gray fuzzball sticking out from between Anadeli's feet. Click, click, click. I worked my way across the top of the mapped area, then dropped down and worked my way back. You have to make sure not to count the same nest twice, but it's almost impossible because they're not in a neat grid. When I was done, I did it over again and got the same number. Here's what surprised me about penguins. Their chests aren't pure white, but have patches of peach and green, which is partially digested krill and algae vomit, which splatters on them when they feed their chicks. Another thing is, penguins stink, and they're loud. They coo sometimes, which is very soothing, but mostly they screech. The penguins I watched spent most of their time waddling over and stealing rocks from one another, then having vicious fights where they'd peck each other until they bled. I climbed high on the rocks and looked out. There was ice in every possible form stretching forever. Glaciers, fast ice, icebergs, chunks of ice in the still water. The air was so cold and clean that even in the way distance, the ice was as vivid and sharp as if it were right in front of me. The immensity of it all, the peacefulness, the stillness, and enormous silence. Well, I could have sat there forever.
What behavior did you observe?
Nick asked when he got back. The penguins that spent most of their time fighting were the ones with no chicks, I said.
There you go, he said.
It's like they're supposed to be taking care of their chicks, but because they don't have any, they have nothing to do with all their energy, so they just pick fights.
I like that.
He checked my work.
This looks good. I need your John Hancock.
I signed at the bottom to verify that I was the scientist. When Nick and I arrived back at the ship, Dad was in the mudroom peeling off his layers. I scanned my ID card. It bonged, and the screen read, Balakrishna, please see official. I scanned it again. Another bong.
That's because you didn't scan out, Nick said. As far as it knows, you're still in the ship.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, said the overhead voice, followed by the big pause. We hope you enjoyed your morning excursion and that you're hungry for some Argentinian barbecue, which is now being served in the dining room.
I was halfway up the stairs when I realized Dad wasn't with me. He was standing at the scanner with a puzzled look on his face.
Dad!
I knew everyone would be charging the buffet line, and I didn't want to get stuck at the end.
Okay, okay,
Dad snapped too, and we beat the lunch crowd. There was no afternoon excursion because we had to cover a huge distance and didn't have time to stop. Dad and I went to the library to look for a game to play. Nick found us there. He handed me some papers.
Here's copies of your data and past data in case you're interested.
So maybe that was his personality. Nice. That's so cool, I said. Do you want to play a game with us?
No, he said. I have packing to do.
Too bad, I told Dad. Because I'd really like to play Risk, but we need three players.
We'll play with you,
a British girl's voice said. It was one of the two girls from Port Lockroy. She and the other girl had handwritten labels stuck to their shirts that said their names, and asked me about Port Lockroy. They were freshly showered with gigantic smiles stretched across their shiny faces.
What are you doing here? I said.
There's not a ship scheduled to visit Port Lockroy for 2 days, said Vivian. So the captain said we should spend the night on the Allegra, said Iris. They both wanted to talk so badly that they were like race car drivers jockeying to cut each other off. It must have been from the lack of anyone else's company.
How are you going to get back? I asked.
There was a change of plans involving Nick, Vivian started.
That's why there's no afternoon excursion, Iris finished.
The Allegra has to take him to Palmer, Vivian said. So we'll end up crossing paths with the next ship to visit Port Lockroy, and Vivian and I will transfer to that. The cruise companies like to keep it hush-hush, though. They like to give the passengers the impression they're all alone in the vast Antarctic Ocean, so these crew transfers are only ever done in the dead of night.
And you'll be pleased to know we've showered, said Vivian.
and they both burst into giggles, ending the talking derby.
"I'm really sorry if I was rude," I said. I turned to Dad, but he was heading down to the bridge. I didn't call after him because Dad knows my strategy for risk, which is to occupy Australia at the outset. Even though Australia is small, there's only one way in and out. So when it comes time to conquer the world, if you don't have Australia, you go in and your armies get trapped there until your next turn. Then the next player can gobble up the single armies you've left in your path. I had the three of us quickly pick our colors and distribute our armies before Dad came back. On my first four turns, I yoinked Australia! Playing Risk with these girls was so fun because in my whole life I've never seen two people happier. That's what a hot shower and peeing in a proper toilet will do. Vivian and Iris told me a funny story about how one day they were sitting at Port Lockroy between cruise ships and a huge fancy yacht pulls up, and it's Paul Allen's yacht, the Octopus, which he and Tom Hanks got off and then requested a tour. I asked the girls if they got to shower on the Octopus, but they said they were too afraid to ask. The freckled lady who called me rude at Port Lockroy sat down with a book and saw me and Vivian and Iris laughing like we'd known one another forever. "Hello," I said to her like a big smiling cat. Before she could respond, the voice over the PA said, "Well, good evening." He was announcing a bunch of whales on the starboard side, which I'd already seen. A few more. "Well, good evenings," came and went, announcing a photography lecture, and then dinner, and then March of the Penguins. But we didn't want to stop the game, so we took turns running plates of food from the dining room up to the library. With each announcement, Dad would pop up and give me the thumbs up through the window, and I'd give him the thumbs up in return. The sun was still blazing, so the only way to judge the passage of time was by the people trickling out of the library. Pretty soon, even Dad stopped appearing, and it was just the three of us playing Risk. Hours must have passed. It was just us and the cleaning crew. Then there seemed to be another, "Well, good evening," but I couldn't be sure because of the vacuum. Then sleepy-eyed passengers with parkas over their pajamas appeared on the deck with their cameras. "What's going on?" I said. It was 2 in the morning. "Oh, we must be at Palmer," Vivian said with a hand flutter. It was her turn, and she actually thought she was about to seize Europe. More people appeared on the deck, but I couldn't see over their heads. Finally, I stood on my chair. Oh, my God! There was a little city, if you'd call a bunch of shipping containers and a couple of corrugated metal buildings a city. "What is that place?" "That's Palmer," Iris said. Palmer was short for Palmer Station. When Nick said he was packing and when Iris said we were dropping Nick off at Palmer, I figured it was to count penguins on some island. "That's where Nick is stationed for the next month," Vivian said. I knew all about the three places in Antarctica where Americans can live. They are McMurdo Station, which looks like an awful dump with about 1,000 people. There's, of course, the South Pole, which is way far inland and impossible to get to with 20 people, and Palmer Station with about 45 people. All three are populated by scientists and support staff. But I had checked the chart room and asked the captain. The Allegra never stopped at Palmer Station. Still, here we were. "Are we getting off?" I asked the girls. "Oh, no," Iris said. "Scientists only," Vivian added. "They run a very tight operation." I dashed out onto the deck. A few Zodiacs streamed back and forth the 200 yards between our ship and Palmer Station. Nick was heading away from us on a Zodiac stacked with coolers and food crates. "Who are those people coming aboard?" I wondered aloud.
"It's a tradition." Charlie, the naturalist, was standing next to me. "We let the scientists at Palmer come aboard for a drink."
I must have had quite a look on my face because Charlie quickly added,
"Nope, people apply 5 years out to get to Palmer. Beds and supplies are extremely limited. Moms from Seattle don't end up there on a whim. I'm sorry to be like that, but, you know."
"Bee," whispered a wild voice. It was Dad. I figured he was asleep because it was 2 in the morning. Before I could speak, he was shepherding me down the stairs.
"I started thinking when your ID didn't scan," he said,
his voice all trembly. What if Bernadette got off the ship, but she didn't scan out? Her ID card would show she was still on board, so everyone would naturally conclude that she had disappeared from the ship itself. But if she got off the ship somewhere and didn't scan out, she might still be there. He pulled open the door to the lounge, which was filling up with some pretty ratty-looking people, scientists from Palmer Station.
Necco Harbor was the last place Mom got off, I said, trying to put it together. And then she got back on.
According to the scan of her ID card, Dad explained again. But what if she slipped off the ship later, without scanning out? I was at the bar just now, and some lady went up and ordered a pink penguin.
A pink penguin? My heart started quaking. That was the drink from the captain's report.
It turns out the lady is a scientist at Palmer Station, Dad said, and the pink penguin is their official drink.
I searched the faces of the new arrivals. They were young and scruffy, like they could all have worked at REI, and full of laughter. Mom's face wasn't among them.
Look at that place, Dad said. I didn't know it existed.
I kneeled on a window seat and peered out. A series of red walkways connected the blue metal buildings. There were a dozen electricity poles sticking up and a water tank with a killer whale painted on it. A gigantic orange ship was docked nearby, nothing like a cruise ship, but more like one of those industrial types that are always in Elliott Bay.
According to the woman, Palmer Station is the plum assignment in all of Antarctica, Dad said. They have a chef who was trained at the Cordon Bleu, for God's sake.
Below, zodiacs were coming and going between our ship and the rocky shore. There was an Elvis mannequin in one of the zodiacs, which the naturalists were videotaping to much hooting and hollering. Who knew? It must have been some inside joke. So the pink penguins on the captain's report, I said, still trying to compute.
They weren't for Bernadette, Dad said. They must have been for a scientist like Nick who was being dropped off at Palmer Station and who Bernadette befriended.
I was still stuck on something. But Mom's ship didn't come anywhere near Palmer Station. Then I realized. I know how we can check.
I ran out of the lounge and down the stairs to the chart room, Dad on my heels. On the shiny wooden block was the map of the Antarctic Peninsula with the little red dotted line showing our journey. I opened the drawer and leafed through the maps until I found the one dated December 26th.
This is the trip Mom took.
I laid it out and placed brass weights on the corners. I traced the red dotted path of Mom's trip. From Tierra del Fuego, the Allegra stopped at Deception Island like we did. Then it looped up and around the Antarctic Peninsula and went deep into the Weddell Sea and back around to Necco Harbor and Adelaide Island. But after that, it turned around and went back through the Bransfield Strait to King George Island and down to Ushuaia. Her boat didn't come near Palmer Station. There was no way around it.
What are these? Dad pointed to gray dashes intersecting the red dotted line.
It happened in three different spots. A current or something, I guess.
No, these aren't currents, Dad said.
Wait, they each have a symbol. It was true. In these gray lines were a snowflake, a bell, and a triangle.
There's got to be a key.
There was. On the bottom left, next to these symbols, were the words Sitka Star South, Lawrence M. Gould, and Antarctic Avalon.
I know the name Lawrence M. Gould from somewhere, I said. They sound like the names of ships, Dad said.
Where do I know it from?
B, Dad said with a huge smile on his face. Look up.
I raised my head. Out the window, that huge ship, all orange hull, in blue block letters, R.V. Lawrence M. Gould.
It crossed paths with Mom's ship, Dad said. And look where it is now.
I was afraid to say what I was thinking.
She's here, B, Dad said. Mom is here.
Hurry, I said. Let's go ask one of those people in the lounge.
Dad grabbed my arm. No, he said. If Mom finds out,
She might pull another disappearing act.
Dad, we're in Antarctica. Where could she go?
He gave me a look like, really?
Okay, 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 I said. But tourists aren't allowed off. How are we
We're gonna steal a Zodiac, he said. We have exactly 40 minutes.
It was then that I realized he was holding our red parkas. He grabbed my hand and we twirled down one, two, three levels until we landed in the mudroom.
How are you both doing tonight? Said a girl behind the counter. Or is it morning already?
It is.
She returned to her paperwork.
We're about to go back upstairs, Dad said loudly.
I pushed him behind a bank of lockers.
Give me the jackets!
I stuffed them in an empty locker and led him to the crew station where I had been with Nick.
On the wall was a line of black parkas.
Put one of those on,
I whispered. I strolled to the floating dock where a Zodiac was tied up. The only crew member was a Filipino. His name tag said Jacko.
I heard one of the sailors talking, I said. The ship is picking up satellite signals from Palmer Station, so they're all on the bridge calling home for free.
Jacko disappeared up into the ship, two steps at a time. I whispered to Dad.
Now!
I zipped myself into a gigantic crew parka and rolled up the sleeves. We grabbed two life vests and clambered into a Zodiac. I unlooped the rope from its cleat, then pushed a button on the motor. The engine coughed to life. We broke from the Allegra and headed across the sparkling black water. I looked back. A few passengers were still on deck taking pictures, but most had retired inside. The Sudoku lady was now in the library. Iris and Vivian sat at our risk game looking out the window. Most of the cabin shades were lowered. As far as the ship was concerned, Dad and I were cozily on board.
Get down, Dad said. A Zodiac was now headed in our direction. You're way smaller than anyone who should be out here.
He stepped in front of the motor and grabbed hold of the wand.
Lower, he said. All the way.
I lay belly down on the plank bottom.
Take off your stupid glasses.
Dad was wearing his clear ones, and the taped-over lens was really noticeable.
Shoot.
He fumbled to stuff his glasses into his pocket and zipped his jacket to above his nose.
Who is it coming toward us? I asked. Can you tell?
Frog, Gilly, and Karen, Dad said, all lockjawed. I'm gonna gently sway this way. Nothing too extreme, just getting a little distance.
He waved at them. I felt their Zodiac pass.
Okay, we're good, he said.
Now I'm looking for a place to dock.
I peeked over the rubber edge. Palmer Station was all around us.
You just ran really fast up onto the rocks, I said.
No, you don't.
Yes, you do, I said, standing up. Just full speed.
Dad did, and I suddenly got pitched onto the inflated rubber edge. I grabbed onto the rope railing, and my body slammed against the outside. My feet and one knee got trapped between the hard rubber and the rocky shore.
Gah! I screamed.
B, are you okay?
I didn't think I was, actually. I'm fine. I pulled free and stood up, wobbly. Oh, no. That other Zodiac had circled back around, and those on board were waving their hands and shouting. At us! I ducked behind the boat.
Go, Dad said.
Where?
Just find her, he said. I'll hold them off. Our ship leaves at 3 a.m. That's 30 minutes from now. Find someone. Ask for Mom. She'll either be here or she won't. If you want to return, you must radio our ship by 2:50. Got that? 2:50.
What do you mean, if I want to return?
I don't know what I mean, said Dad.
I took a big gulp and stared up at the corrugated sprawl.
Make sure you...
Dad reached into his inside pocket and pulled out a small black velvet bag with a gold silk rope.
Give her this.
Without saying goodbye, I limped up the road, most of its gravel eaten away by erosion. On my left and right were shipping containers, different shades of blue, with stenciled signs, reefer, volatile, flam locker, core locker, the bat cave. On wooden decks, tents were set up. They had real doors and funny flags, like a pirate or Bart Simpson. Even though the sun was in the sky,
I was walking through the silence of night. As I continued, the buildings became denser and connected by a habit trail of red bridges and bundled pipes. To my left was an aquarium with squid and starfish pressed up against the glass, and strange sea creatures like from the evening recap. There was a big aluminum drum, and next to it a sign with a martini glass which read, "Absolutely no glass containers near the hot tub." I arrived at the steps leading to the main building. Halfway up, I dared to look back. The other Zodiac had pulled next to Dad's. One of the guides had climbed into it. There seemed to be some arguing going on, but Dad stayed positioned at the motor, which meant the guides had their backs to me. So far, I hadn't been spotted. I opened the door and found myself alone in a big, toasty room with carpet tiles and a row of aluminum picnic tables. It smelled like an ice rink. One wall was devoted to shelves filled with DVDs. Toward the back was a counter and an open stainless steel kitchen. On a dry erase board were the words, "Welcome home, Nick." Laughter erupted from somewhere. I ran down the hall and started opening doors. One room was nothing but walkie-talkies plugged into charging stations. A huge sign read, "No coffee mugs allowed except for Joyce's." The next room was desks and computers and oxygen tanks. One was just weird scientific machines. Then there was a bathroom. I heard voices from around the corner. I ran toward them. Then I tripped. On the floor was a spaghetti pot sitting atop a flattened-out trash bag. Inside the spaghetti pot was a T-shirt with something familiar on it, a rainbow handprint. I reached down and picked it out of the cold gray water. Gaylor Street School! "Dad!" I cried. "Daddy!" I ran back down the hall to the wall of windows. Both Zodiacs were zooming away from Palmer Station toward our ship. Dad was in one of them. Then, at my back,
"You little rotter."
It was Mom standing there. She was wearing Carhartt pants and a fleece. "Mom!" Tears sprang up in my eyes. I ran to her. She dropped to her knees, and I just hugged her so hard and buried my body in her. "I found you." She had to carry all my weight in her arms because I had just given up. I stared into her beautiful face, her blue eyes examining me like they always used to.
"What are you doing here?" she said. "How did you get here?"
Her wrinkles radiated like sun rays from her smiling eyes. There was a big stripe of gray running down her part. "Look at your hair," I said.
"You almost killed me," she said.
"You know that?" Then with tears and confusion, "Why didn't you write?" "I didn't know where you were," I said. "My letter," she said.
"Your letter?" "I sent it weeks ago."
"I never got your stupid letter," I said.
"Here, this is from Dad." I handed her the velvet bag. She knew what it was and pressed it to her cheek and closed her eyes.
"Open it," I said. She untied the cord and pulled out a locket. In it was the photograph of Saint Bernadette. It was the necklace Dad had given her after she won her architecture prize. It was the first time I'd ever seen it.
"What's this?"
She pulled out a card and held it away from her face.
I can't read what it says.
I took it from her and read it aloud. 1, Bieber bifocal. 2, 20 mile house. 3, B. 4, your escape. 14 miracles to go.
LG, Mom said, and breathed out a sweet, relaxed smile.
"I knew I'd find you," I said, and hugged her my tightest. "Nobody believed me, but I knew."
"My letter," Mom said.
"If you never got it..." She pulled my arms apart and looked into my face.
"I don't understand, B. If you never got my letter, how are you here?"
"I did it like you," I said. I slipped away.
Part 7. The Runaway Bunny. Monday,
February 21st.
My first day back at Gaylor Street, on the way to music, I passed my cubby. It was stuffed with notices from the past few months, crammed in with all the flyers about the recycling challenge and bike to